we're all figuring out.
Starting with Domio.
Domio.
Myoju.
Myoju.
Phil.
Phil.
John.
John.
Don.
Don.
Susan.
Susan.
Jeff.
Jeff.
Sam.
Sam.
Coral.
Coral.
Jen Rio.
Jen Rio.
Bob.
Bob.
Richard.
Richard.
Paul.
Paul.
Ruthann.
Ruthann.
Gina.
Gina.
Shukatsu.
Shukatsu.
Diane.
Diane.
Zach.
Zach.
Ted.
Ted.
Mark.
Mark.
Claudia.
Claudia.
Jeff.
Jeff.
Cody.
Cody.
Jill.
Jill.
Cameron.
Cameron.
All right, in terms of announcement, the next big thing is the potluck, the summer potluck, on the 13th of July at 6 o'clock. It'll be 6 to 8, 6 to 9. I think it's pretty flexible and it's at my house.
What
13th is a Saturday. Saturday, and we already have 25 to 30 people that are coming, but there's no limit. I mean, I guess. We just spread out in the yard or something. But yeah, so please come for that and bring a vegetarian dish or a beverage or dessert or anything, and a picnic blanket if you want to sit on the grass. Nice. So that's on the 13th. And then the 14th is Rins. We have a guest speaker, Rinzan, and he's the teacher at No Rank Zendo. It's a different school of Zen than ours. It's a Rinzai school where they do more koans and stuff. But he's a good teacher, a good speaker. And then we have a book group on the 20th and poetry group on the 27th. And you. Retreat coming up?
I'm still registered for session, August 20th through 25th. Everybody's probably heard about it.
Yeah.
If not, and you're curious, just ask me afterwards. Think that's the other thing is what?
The book you were
going. Yes. So starting next week, we will be using this book, Active Hope. Oh, it is. By Joanna Macy and Chris Johnstone, and it isn't an explicitly Buddhist book, but Joanna Macy's Buddhist, and it's definitely inspired by and compatible with Buddhism. And what I plan to do is take a chapter at a time, and I will also bring in some, at least one Buddhist teaching and practice that is related as well. The newsletter will be keeping you up with where we are, but also on the website you can find under Tuesday Study kind of the schedule of what chapter we'll be on, what week. And I find this is a book that I read a few years ago, and one of the few books that I've just read cover to cover right off the bat, just because it's, I mean, Joanna Macy's, she spent her life doing this. So it's, I mean, I could write a book about what I think should be done and I think you should think about the environment and reacting to the things in the world, but that would just be my ideas. Hers are like, she knows this from experience, what actually works with people, what actually helps people. Like, it's Active Hope, how to face the mess we're in without going crazy. So her idea of active hope, which actually we're going to get to a little bit tonight, is not about your sense of whether something is going to happen or not. It's about what do you want to have happen, and then you dedicate yourself to helping that come about. So it's about what you do, not about what you're hoping for. So you can be hopeless and still have active hope in a way. So there's three more copies at $12 a piece if you are like to buy things the old-fashioned way. I noticed Powell's did not have any actually on its shelves. but you can still get copies of it also online if you want to be following along. And we, you know, we won't be reading out loud from it. I mean, I read excerpts, kind of like I'm going to do tonight, but mostly I'll just be talking about it. And just as long as I was ordering books for the Zen Center, I ordered, this is a new book by Stephanie Kaza called Green Buddhism, and this is a library copy, so if anybody wants to go ahead and check this out, I just wanted to let you know it was available. So tonight, actually, going back to Zen teachings in challenging times, however, it's all pretty relevant because this is a chapter called Showing Up in Troubled Times by Enkyo Pat O'Hara. So it's pretty related. So let's see. I'll do a little bit of reading. She says, a beloved Buddhist image is that of a bodhisattva who steers a raft filled with suffering beings across a sea of troubled waters to the shore of peace and clarity. In 13th century Japan, in the midst of fearfully changing times, Zen Master Dogen wrote, "What can I accomplish? Although not yet a Buddha, let my priest's body be the raft to carry sentient beings to the yonder shore. It is a humble, poignant wish to let one's own body serve to awaken others, awaken them to the reality of our interpenetrated universe, where nothing is separate, nothing exists without all the rest in that moment. That a devout, brilliant philosopher monk might take on the profound responsibility of carrying suffering beings across the sea of despair seems to me to challenge each of us to investigate how we can make of ourselves a raft, and thus survive and help others to cope in these troubling times." And indeed, these days are deeply distressing and challenging for the many of us who, until recently, felt as if our world were slowly changing into a more compassionate and rational one. Perhaps naively, we thought that the threat to the health of our planet was beginning to be met, that hunger and disease, partisanship and violence, racism and elitism were all on the wane. And we are shocked and awakened to the reality that the countervailing forces of greed, anger, and ignorance have gained strength and are now exerting control in different parts of the planet. Difficult as it is to take in to our consciousness, we are witnessing a harsh rebalancing of worldview and of power.
This is a pretty recent book.
Yes. Yes, Zen Teachings in Challenging Times, 2018. So, just a forewarning, disclaimer, I'm sure I'm going to cry during this presentation at some point tonight. Don't worry about me, it just happens. I just figured it was appropriate to mention what's going on at the migrant detention camps. As many of you may know, the mounting evidence that the conditions down in the detention centers are just inhumane, unbelievable that they can be happening in our country to innocent people, to children. The evidence that 5 infants at the McAllen facility, 5 infants were sent to a neonatal intensive care unit because of influenza, and that therefore a doctor got to go in to the facility, otherwise they wouldn't have been able to go in. Examined 39 children under the age of 18 facing conditions including extreme cold temperatures, lights on 24 hours a day, no adequate access to medical care, basic sanitation, water, or adequate food. All 39 exhibited signs of trauma. In mid-June, at the Warren, advocate Warren Binford gained access to a Clint, Texas Border Patrol facility where 351 migrant children were detained. Over 100 were under 13. The youngest was just over 4 months. Binford reported that many of the kids had been held for 3 weeks or longer and that guards had created a child boss who was rationed extra food in an attempt to control the other children. Many people have heard of the situations that they've discovered where the youth are being held with dirty clothes, you know, without access to showers, without access to soap and toothpaste. Just this last weekend, a bunch of politicians visited these and they really tried to limit their interactions, but apparently these ballsy folks just kind of elbowed their way into enclosures and talked to the detainees even though they weren't supposed to, and are reporting terrible conditions. And then they just discovered a secret Facebook group of 9,500 former and current Customs and Border Patrol agents that featured jokes about migrants' deaths, obscene images of Hispanic lawmakers, and threats to members of Congress. So basically just blowing off the whole thing. So, what is our response? And that's what this chapter is about. What is our response? It often feels like we really have only two options. And one is to dwell on this stuff, to feel angrier and angrier, or more and more despair, or sadness, or grief, or frustration, to feel compelled to do something, but what? To feel guilty for not doing anything, get discouraged by our lack of progress, or the compromises we have to make, or the infighting among those we're trying to work with. It feels like a mess. I mean, we feel drawn toward witnessing and compassion, but it looks like a kind of, sometimes a fruitless and scary path to go down. Or we can take the option two, a larger perspective, or ironically, this is also kind of a this moment, here and now perspective. There has always been injustice and suffering. Every generation thinks the world is going to hell in a handbasket. Things work themselves out eventually. We can only deal with what is right in front of us. We benefit the world by maintaining peace, at least in our own hearts, by meeting the people in our lives, in our homes, maintaining peace there by trying to minimize the harm we do. Through our meditation practice and other various practices, the various ways that we give and try to be of benefit in the world, have faith that they have impact. It doesn't help if we succumb to despair, right? So the second approach helps us keep our sanity, but it does little to motivate us to act. Now there's a third option, and this is something that is presented by Zen. It may not be exactly explicit in terms of like acting in response to world suffering, but here it is. So, this is Enkyo O'Hara again. What raft can we construct that will serve to strengthen us, create resilience, so that we can act to serve skillfully? As in so many times in the past, I turn again to Dogen and his opening words in an early writing, the Genjo Koan. It is a text beloved by many and truly is a balm for these times. Who knew, right? I mean, we recite the Genjo Koan on Tuesdays sometimes. Sometimes it's not immediately obvious how that could be a balm for, you know, facing the suffering of our times. Dogen initially wrote Genjo Koan for a layman and Dharma student, Koshu Yo, who lived in Kyushu province. At that time, that area faced threats from China and the Korean Peninsula. both frighteningly close to this extremity of the Japanese archipelago. Moreover, at the time when Dogen began writing Genjo Koan, there had been weird weather. Snow in summer, and crops had been ruined, and so there was a famine. It was said that corpses lay on the streets of Kyoto. And within the political realm, there was great change, with the samurai class taking over the rule of Japan from the emperor and his court. Buddhist groups fought one another. Theft in the monasteries was rampant. It was a grievous time, and like today, called for wisdom and discerning bodhisattva activity. Today, like layman Koshu-yo, most of us are living multidimensional lives with the needs of our personal relations, work relations, sangha relations, our own inner struggles to understand our lives, the world around us, and our response as citizens in a world that needs us. How do we show up for this? The first words of Genjo Koan show me a way, helping me to balance my life, to live in Buddha Dharma, and to act in everyday life. These are the opening lines. As all things are Buddha Dharma, there are delusion, realization, practice, life and death, Buddhas and sentient beings. As myriad dharmas are without an abiding self, there is no delusion, no realization, no Buddha, no sentient being, no birth and death. The Buddha way, in essence, is leaping clear of abundance and lack. Thus, there are birth and death, delusion and realization, sentient beings and Buddhas. So the first of these three verses, the first verse has to do with what we call the relative world, the relative aspect of reality. Relative, contingent, phenomena, difference, manifestation. Things are bad and good, harmful and helpful, wise and foolish, and all of that. And O'Hara says, in order to serve the world, we must realize the way things are. This is a radical acceptance of now. We're not saying this is okay. We're saying this is what is now. Now the second verse, as myriad things are without an abiding self, there is no delusion, no realization. So this is what we call the absolute aspect of reality. The essential, the principle, equality, unity, the ultimate. In this very next line, Dogen reverses energy and reminds us that the ordinary ways we have of structuring reality are simply convenient temporary tags, illusory ways of thinking. As he said, as myriad beings, things are without abiding self. We stop again and imagine no edges to our being, no self that persists all day, but rather just the moment, or not even the moment, but this vast, empty moment. There is such release, such succor, such bottomless truth in this realization. All that we think and hold dear, our own selves and our stories, and others and the world, it is all on one level merely a structure, a way of organizing the impulses to our senses. Dropping that, there is no me or you or cruelty or kindness. There is just this mind moment. That this empty reality is also present in our lives offers us a glimpse of a deeper truth, a resonance we fail to notice in our to-ing and fro-ing through our lives. Just this, the silence that has no name, even the soft breeze, the warm sun, the night air, just, with no name or label. It is a showing up of everything all at once, with no walls or borders. So, this is something that we try to develop a relationship with or have a sense of through our Zen practice. Generally, we have a pretty good sense of the relative. I mean, we may be caught in it, but we're very familiar with operating in that aspect of reality. It's very difficult to get your minds, it's impossible really, to get your mind around this whole absolute relative two sides of the same thing. They're like, we have scriptures that say they're like two steps in walking. They're not actually separate aspects of reality. This is just the nature of reality that it has two aspects. But I guess, you know, usually the most effective way to explain this, even though I do have a handy chart, if you're at all interested, but a contingent on one side, the essential on the other, because there's all kinds of different pairs in Zen that we use to describe this, and it's really evoking the same thing, so once you kind of, oh, I see. But I guess the most effective way is just to describe this experientially, where, you know, if that all we perceive is the relative aspect of reality, things can end up seeming quite hopeless. Even if there are temporary gains, there's always loss. It can be very overwhelming. And even if we've made a success over here, even if our lives are peaceful, even if we've achieved some justice, you know, on the other side of the planet, people are suffering, you know, intensely. So, and we are not separate from them. So we can't insulate ourselves from that pain and suffering. We may try, but ultimately, if we want our hearts to be open, we can't. So that's, you know, kind of being stuck in that relative. And having a taste of the absolute does not, it does not deny the relative. That's where, because we're so dualistic in our thinking, we think, you know, it's one or the other. One, and they deny, they contradict. But I guess to describe what I touch, what I think of when things seem so unbelievably tragic and sad. I mean, you may have heard me say this before, it may sound kind of intense, but if I thought I could save the monarch butterflies by killing myself, I think I would do it. Just the monarch butterflies. Not even the polar bears, not even, you know, just the monarch butterflies. Of course, life doesn't work that way. So don't worry, I'm not thinking about it. It just doesn't work that way. But, I mean, that's the kind of love and longing that I feel for the world. And so how can I find any solace knowing that probably within my lifetime they will be gone? You can't find any solace in the relative. You can't, like, well, let's see, you know, let's add up the pros and cons, and like, no, that is not okay. That is, there's no way you can add things up on the relative side where that is okay. And yet, when we let go of all of our efforts to make sense of the world, all of our efforts to try to control the outcome, and we realize things are just as they are, and it's a miracle there ever were modern butterflies. Is it tragic that they go away? Yes. It all ends up looking like a miraculous play of energy is all I can say. It does not nullify the relative, as I said, but it... reality is just one big luminous whole. When it is undivided, when we let go of our expectations of how things should be, there are organs in your body right now taking toxins out of your blood as you sit here and listen. I mean, life is an absolute miracle. And we expect that there should be justice. We expect that we should act in harmony with one another. You know, who said, why should it be that way? We may want to, maybe worth giving our lives to try to make it that way. But there was no rule book. There was no one that said that this was going to be fair or easy. So, I don't know if that conveys any of this other aspect of reality. Now we can get stuck in that aspect of reality. Just as we can get stuck in the relative, we can get stuck in this sense of like, I mean, you'll hear people talk about this. They'll say like, well, you know, there's been a number of extinctions over the course of the planet. You know, the planet will recover. And in a certain sense, you can take a certain measure of large perspective solace in that, I suppose. I know I do to a certain extent. It wouldn't be the end of life, period. But really, like, you know, your heart has to be pretty closed down. You have to be in a lot of denial to be able to contemplate that with, like, a shrug. So, let's go on. So, amazingly, we have this third verse, though. So the third verse, the Buddha way, in essence, is leaping clear of abundance and lack. Thus, there are birth and death, delusion and realization, sentient beings, and Buddha. So this is O'Hara. But wait, Dogen's next line brings us to yet another view. The heart of the teaching, the Buddha way, the way of awakening, leaps clear or jumps over, is not stopped by our views of reality as either just our everyday life or as emptiness. Instead, this line teaches that the Buddha way leaps over both getting caught in the everydayness of life and getting caught in the empty vastness of undifferentiated reality. This is to wake up. This is to neither grasp what is here nor ignore what is here. It is to show up. Indeed, these times are very scary, and I must act to ensure the well-being of those in need of food and medical care and housing and basic human rights. The demand is great, and all my efforts are required to meet this moment, the needs that are in front of me. And I must also realize that even while in the heat of action, there is a reality also present at each moment that disentangles difference, disentangles you versus me, and unknots the knot of difference and inequality. Allowing this leaping clear prevents us from becoming ideological warriors or martyrs, and opens our hearts to the deepest truth, the interconnected quality of all life throughout space and time. Thus, we can express skillful, non-harming action towards everyone. And then she points out how the end of the Genjo Koan also illustrates this relationship. So, as many of you are familiar, this is a slightly different translation than we use, but Mayu, Zen Master Baoshe, was fanning himself. A monk approached and asked, "Master, the nature of wind is permanent, and there is no place it does not reach. Why then do you fan yourself?" "Although you understand the nature of wind is permanent," Mayu replied, "you do not understand the meaning of it reaching everywhere." "What is the meaning of it reaching everywhere?" asked the monk again. Mayu just kept fanning himself. The monk bowed deeply. So to unpack this a little bit, the in a way, the fan and the heat is a metaphor here for, you know, if essentially life is precious and perfect just as it is, why are you fanning yourself? It's kind of hot in here. I read this as why do we have to practice if essentially everything's perfect to begin with? Why do we have to practice? But I also read it as, you know, so this monk is going up and like, so here's this master fanning himself, and right, shouldn't he be like, the master is awakened to this realm of no difference, then he shouldn't be troubled by heat, right? Why are you fanning yourself if, you know, essentially there is no heat and no cold? And the master basically says, you don't really understand what that means. And so the monk, with some humility at least, says, what does that mean? And, you know, that's the answer. So he doesn't say, let's see, the third. So the master doesn't respond to the monk by defending himself about talking about how hot it is. And even though in an absolute sense hot and cold are just judgments we make, in another sense you can still suffer heat stroke. And he doesn't respond with an argument about he really doesn't actually need the coolness of the fan, so because it's optional that he uses it, he can go ahead and use it. I mean, he's not arguing, he just continues that action. And in a way, this is what the leaping beyond is. It's not a philosophical thing. It's when we take action, when we leap beyond either of those, there's a way that, I don't know, reality manifests. All of the rest of the stuff in some ways is just concepts. We still act, not caught in neither extreme. So some of us today went to a small Close the Camps rally in downtown Beaverton today. And we can always argue that such and such a thing doesn't really make a difference or isn't enough or whatever. But I found that taking some action, and I'm not the only one who's found this, taking some action catapults us out of being stuck in either the absolute or the relative, catapults us out of overwhelm, paralysis, and despair. And what can we do? I mean, that is where our minds go. What can we do? So I don't know how many of you know who Greta Thunberg is. Mm-hmm. So she's a now 16-year-old Swedish girl who, I'm going to pass around a picture. Her personal activism began in August 2018. And this is a picture of her, which I will pass around, sitting all by herself outside the Swedish parliament with a sign, "School Strike for Climate." And, you know, God bless her parents, let her do this. And she handed out leaflets saying, "We kids most often don't do what you tell us to do. We do as you do. And since you grown-ups don't give a shit about my future, I won't either." And since, so this wasn't that long ago, the school strike for climate has spread to 125 countries and involved over 1 million students. And it still is going on. So I'm going to pass that around. There's little Greta Thunberg, who now most recently, the UK Parliament, she addressed the UK Parliament. Like, it was a televised speech, and this 16-year-old Swedish girl with English as her second language. And she's, I highly recommend you look her up, because it turns out that she's actually on the autism spectrum, and And she explains it as, like, this is a strength, because she just sees it in black and white, and she does not get shaken. She does not get all emotional. She is just like, we are running out of time. Things are going to change, whether you want them to change or not. I mean, she's just laying it right out there. So I ran across a really sweet article where Greta Thunberg had a conversation with Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez. They didn't get to meet face to face. They were meeting via video, because I guess one thing, Greta doesn't fly out of her strike for climate. So, I imagine most people are familiar somewhat with AOC. So she's one of our youngest members of Congress, and she beat incumbent Democrat who had been there for ages, who wasn't all that bad, but she just had this grassroots, and, you know, for change, and she's really great. So AOC says, "I wonder what to you is encouraging and what keeps you going. There's a school of thought, I personally disagree with it, that says if you educate people too much about the climate, they're going to think it's too late, and they're going to wallow in despair and not act at all. So I'm curious, given how daunting the issue is, why aren't you so filled with despair that you're staying on your couch every day and just waiting for the apocalypse?" And Greta says, "Before I started school striking, I was like that. I was so depressed, and I didn't want to do anything, basically. But what I find encouraging is having all these people who are fighting on different sides in different ways to create a better future and to make us avoid catastrophic climate breakdown. The school striking children, when I see them, that is very hopeful." AOC says, "I had a similar tipping point, although it had more to do with income inequality. Many people know that several years ago, I was working in a restaurant, and I had gone to college, and I had worked on so many things, but my family had fallen into a lot of misfortune. My father had gotten sick, and so on. And I was working in this restaurant, and I would go in, day out, and I was so depressed. I felt so powerless, as though there was nothing I could do that could effectively counter the enormous number of societal structures that are designed in the U.S. to keep the working class poor and to keep the rich richer. I was really wallowing despair for a while. What did I do? Is this my life? Just showing up, working, knowing that things are going to be so difficult, and going home and doing it again. And I think what was profoundly liberating was engaging in my first action. When I went to Standing Rock in the Dakotas to fight against a fracking pipeline, it seemed impossible at the time. It was just normal people showing up, just standing on the land to prevent this pipeline from going through. And it made me feel extremely powerful, as though, even though we had nothing materially, just the act of standing up to some of the most powerful corporations in the world. From there, I learned that hope is not something that you have. Hope is something that you create with your actions. Hope is something you have to manifest into the world. And once one person has hope, it can be contagious. Other people start acting in a way that has more hope." So Greta says, "Yeah, I know so many people who feel hopeless. They ask me, what should I do? I say, act, do something, because that is the best medicine against sadness and depression. I remember the first day I was school striking outside the Swedish parliament. I felt so alone because everyone went straight past. No one even looked at me. But at the same time, I was hopeful." AOC says, "It's true that people don't know that when those small actions can manifest into something. I've even seen it in office. There's so much cynicism about how powerful can this be, just me showing up. I think sometimes we're so obsessed with measurement. What does me standing outside of Parliament with a sign do? It doesn't lower any carbon emissions immediately, doesn't change any laws directly. But what it does is make powerful people feel something. And people underestimate the power of that. It's becoming harder and harder for elected officials to look people in the eye. Just this morning, I was sent a picture of an older gentleman from the Midwest. which has just seen some catastrophic flooding. We're starting to see flooding in the U.S. where there was never flooding before. In the Midwest, there's a disaster package that's not getting passed, and he was just there with a sign saying, "Do you care about me?" He stood outside the congressional building knowing that members are going to have to pass by him, and it's very much inspired, I would say, by the actions that you've taken. The biggest weapon people have is to try to make you think you don't matter. It is to say this doesn't change anything. Because if you can convince people that it doesn't matter, then they won't do it, and people can go on as though it's business as usual. So, I'll open it up in a moment. But I did want to, you know, we're starting now, and then we're going to be moving into active hope. One thing that I would like to invite us to consider as a community is really, I want to say, I don't see anybody in here wanting to get into the act of shaming anybody, but I want to be really sensitive to the fact that what we need now is solidarity and not for anybody to feel guilty or inadequate or anything. That's like, because it's so easy once we start talking about activism or whatever to just go like, well, I'm not doing enough, and oh, but you're doing more. You know what you should, you know, there's all kinds of shoulds and subtle senses of shaming and one-upmanship that happen. And I've recently found another article I really love that I won't read to you, but the title of it is, "I work in the environmental movement. I don't care if you recycle." And she really points out that, you know, for the last 50 years, this has been a very, very deliberate campaign on the part of corporations, basically, to shift the responsibility onto us. And it's us, and it's our lifestyle, and it's our choices, and do we litter, or do we, you know, recycle, or do we eat meat, or do we... And all of those things are important. But as long as we stay focused on them, and that's the only things that we can talk about together, we're going to remain distracted from the main points. We're not going to have the solidarity that we need. And honestly, I think we could waste so much time and energy just worrying about trying to get our lives in some kind of perfect, you know, saintly green order, and never have the time and energy to do anything, to speak up, when there's all kinds of stuff that we can do. There's obviously voting. I'm a neighborhood leader. I go around and remind my neighbors to vote whenever there's an election. You can join a campaign of somebody that you really believe in and make phone calls for them or write postcards for them. Or, you know, you can... Turns out we don't need a plastic bag ban in Beaverton because they just passed a statewide plastic bag ban. So on any of these kinds of things, there's plenty of stuff for us to do, different kinds of things for different kinds of people. So I just hope that we kind of just, I don't know, like, have conversations about, you know, where you should buy stuff from somewhere else. You know, if you want to form an email group and talk about green consumerism, that's fine. But in a way, invite us to look beyond that in our discussions. All right. Any thoughts? Any comments?
Yeah, Julia, I was going to say that Prabhupada used to say that enlightenment means having a broken heart of sadness. Enlightenment feels like that.
Hmm.
So when your heart breaks, when you see suffering, maybe that's touching the absolute.
Maybe. I think it, you know, the, I think about the Vajrayana practice of Tonglen, mm-hmm. which it might, sounds like maybe a strange practice, but you imagine the suffering and the sadness, and you breathe it in, or you take it in, and then what you breathe out is peace and love. And I don't know if the Vajrayana people do this, but a Zen teacher I had who was having us do this suggested that in a way, when we take that in, like we kind of throw it all into emptiness. You know, you just kind of, it's because obviously you're not holding it, you're not keeping it. You're not like taking it on as a burden and like, oh, here's some of my joy you can have. You know, the idea is that it's kind of like this can just be transformed. And I don't know, to be able to let our heart break and not be destroyed by it.
It does seem more like destroying when your heart doesn't break.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's why we are where we are, don't you think? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've done Tonglen in public situations, like stuck on a bus where somebody's being obnoxious, or stuck on an airplane where a baby is very unhappy with the oxygen level as their ears hurt. And actually, if you detach, it's amazing how much it works. But I went a month ago to hear Esther and Abraham Hicks and took some notes. And one of the first things she said is, leap out in front of your own positive thoughts. And I thought, leap. That's the fourth precept verb. Like, leap out over the unholy and the holy when we're thinking good things for all living things.
Wow.
And I like that action verb. The lawyer said, hope that doesn't take action, any action gets toxic. So, you know, any action, even if it's picking up the phone and calling those people in Salem and saying, get back to work.
Leap out in front of your positive thoughts. I like that.
Well, that was Hicks, and then the precepts of leap out over the leap beyond, unholy and holy.
Yeah.
So I thought, I didn't read that word.
Well, I got to dance around in the street in front of City Hall a week ago Friday. I participated in the Extinction Rebellion action down there. And, you know, so, I mean, I wasn't risking arrest because I was ready to leave if the cops were coming around, because, frankly, I had to leave town with my husband. But I do plan to risk arrest at future actions. As I told one of the organizers of the local chapter of Extinction Rebellion, which uses civil disobedience to pressure governments to act on climate change, I told him, well, you know, I'm probably one of the few people that, like, theoretically my cachet could just increase if I got arrested as a priest, you know. but it was a jubilant action. It was like, we just went from a climate rally in the park, which would have been fine, you know, a bunch of people who care about the environment talking to each other, giving speeches and cheering each other on. You know, there's about 300 people, that's okay, but not big enough to really for anybody to notice. But then we just walked out of the park and we just walked into the street. And Extinction Rebellion had a giant bright green fire truck that they used to block the street. Said, this is a climate emergency. It was a real fire truck. I don't know where they got it. I don't know where they got it. I don't know if they were borrowing it or what. But and then they just closed off the street and, you know, put up tents. And people were, like, juggling and singing and given speeches, and they stayed there for about 4 hours, and they were ready to get arrested, but it looked like the cops were willing to just let them stay there for a long time. Which, as my husband pointed out, they're like, they're kind of used to that whole area. They're like, whatever.
Which was it?
Huh?
West Street or was it?
It was, so, I mean, it's right in front of City Hall, so it's...
Fourth.
I think it was, fourth. And like, if I'm going to go over to the east side, I go downtown, yeah. I go down that street, and then I turn and get on the Hawthorne Bridge. Yeah. So it's like a major throughfare there.
Yeah. But between Madison and Maine.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Susan was there singing with the Raging Grannies. So there's all kinds of different ways. I mean, that's what's so cool, is that, you know, if you enjoy that kind of humorous and singing and that kind of thing, and then Extinction Rebellion also has, they have different working groups, and so if you don't want to risk arrest or anything like that, they have the art group, and they have the media group, the people are looking like, how is this going to look, you know, when people take pictures and post them on social media. There's all different kinds of things that they do.
Lots of young people, which I like. Yeah, that's really good. That's one thing we saw a lot more of the Pride celebrations this year with young people, and that doesn't just mean teenagers, I mean like the little ones, like their parents, their little rainbow boats, little train flags around their heads. It's so cute. Yeah, that gets you home from there.
Shall I take? And getting into comparing, well, what could be better than that? Well, this, well, what about that? And
I know.
And I'm really relieved to hear this really nicely done by you and the other writers. So, articulation of how that is body and that just taking some action, leaping ahead, it does have a sort of lightning feeling. Just even the national right now, it feels lighter. I obsess too much about the relative power of the many, many letters that I've written to national and local leaders.
Yeah.
And who knows if this had any impact whatsoever. But I remain hopeful that, you know, and this is such a beautiful story about this little girl, that she's kind of like a little butterfly who flapped her wings and look what's happened. So.
And I heard it described somewhere someday, because I used to be, and still am to some extent, really obsessed with these pivotal people like Martin Luther King, Gandhi, and Mother Teresa, and just like, these people are just so, just had an impact just so much bigger than any of us. And yet, if you look at it, they're rarely that they were so remarkable, it's just kind of, they were the right person at the right time. And I just thought, you know, a year earlier, nobody might have noticed Greta at all. Just everything was coming together, and now, you know, she's catapulted. But, you know, it's the same kinds of actions, and we don't know what kind of impact they're going to have. And I just, you know, one of our teachings is the importance of Sangha. And not only can we support one another in these things, but we can find other kind of sanghas of sorts where we are supported in whatever actions we feel called to do. Because I'm also part of an indivisible group, and it's really awesomely run. And once a month, you get together with a whole bunch of like-minded neighbors. And like, it's a... We cheer each other on. You know, people that, because that's focused around making calls and writing letters and speaking to your members of Congress and stuff like that. So, you know, they're like, this is what we managed to make happen. And we got this bill passed because we put this pressure on. And, you know, so it's like this, I don't know, you get in this room full of people and you start to go, yeah, we could do it. It really makes a huge difference.
we're not doing it by ourselves. Everybody looks really thoughtful. And I really hope, you know, just, I just, you know, let's shrug off any sense of guilt or inadequacy or anything. I don't know. Maybe you're not doing anything right now. But just going, maybe I'll do something. And then, you know, just kind of open the door and maybe something will happen along. And I know for a long, long time, I feel like I've kind of sat on the sidelines going like, I know, but Dad, no. You know, like I went to a 350.org meeting and I'm like, I don't know. You know, it just, because we have limited time and energy. And I don't know, it's going to kind of be the right match to some extent. And yet, I don't know, if we think a little more open-mindedly, we usually can find something. All right, well, thank you, Will.
Thank you.